No, I say. No. The contents of the house go with the house. You are not removing another thing. Look, he says. This is weird, okay? I couldn't give a crap about this house or the will or any of it. I don't even care if my parents get it or you get it or it falls into the sea, frankly. But my mom is on her high horse. She... Well, if we had all day, I could tell you the whole story, but it's pointless and stupid, and I happen to have all day. He lets out one of his huge sighs again and gives me one of his guilty conscience looks, and we go into the kitchen. I get the feeling somehow that he wants to tell me the whole story, to get it off his chest. He grabs a beer from the fridge and admires the shininess of the turkey fat sparkling floor, and he actually laughs about that a little.
Ha ha, wasn't that something? You and your fiancé? And the way the turkey skidded across the room just at the moment Jeremy realized you'd been living with me?
Hilarious, I say. I'm still so mad at him, but fascinated by him too, in the way that I always have been and probably always will be. And we sit down at the scarred old table, and he drums his fingers on the table. And then he begins.
So, Blix was the one who was supposed to get my family's mansion, the one that got passed down through the generations, oldest daughter to oldest daughter. But she got cut out of the will after what were probably high-level shenanigans, knowing my parents, and, well, whatever. My mom's mom ended up with the house instead.
After that start, he has to get up and pace around, and the story is like something from some Southern Gothic Network TV miniseries. It all started back with robber barons and war heroes and wills and pistols at dawn, but basically the part that meant something was that Blix got cheated out of the family mansion, and no one knows that his mother has always been squirrely, his word, about Blix, maybe because she feels guilty for what they did. She was always proclaiming how, in her own defense, she took much better care of the house than Blix would have, and how she was so much more connected to the community and had so many charitable causes. But meanwhile, Blix traveled around the world and then went off to Brooklyn, of course, and the family watched with consternation as she took up with all those alternative things. Magic and mayhem, Wendy called it.
She would never admit this, but I think she was kind of worried that Blix was going to do voodoo on her or something, get the house back, or expose her. And so, now that Blix has died, and this is strictly my theory, my mom is desperate to get Blix's papers and find out what she was up to all those years. And if she has to, she'll prove that Blix was never in her right mind, and therefore, for that to happen, you should be cut out of the will.
Speechless, I say. I am utterly speechless.
Yeah, it's ugly. This is why I never wanted to have much to do with my parents. My dad wanted me to go into business, learn all the ropes of his firm, but nope. I picked teaching school and going to Africa. And now I just want to do more of that. I'm scheduled to leave the country next week, going to Bali this time.
To Bali? Aren't you in school? He grins.
Actually, that would be a no.
But you said that was why you wanted to stay here. I see his face.
No? You were never taking classes.
No, I told you that so I could stay. I didn't have anything else going, and besides, I kind of was intrigued by you. You know, you're hot. And, well, my mom wanted me to keep an eye on what was going on here.
Wow.
I sit back in my chair. Okay, so let me get this straight. So basically, you're dismantling this house to help your mom get it away from me then?
You have no stake in it.
Pretty much.
He ducks his head.
Sorry.
Well, then why don't you stop? Why don't you right now, this minute, stop it?
I would, I really would, but you don't know my mom. She's relentless. She talks to me every day, getting more and more worked up.
He gives me a guilty little smile.
Also, I've already sent her a whole bunch of boxes of Blix's stuff, including, and I'm sorry about this, Marnie, I really am. I sent her that letter Blix wrote you, and her book of spells.
I think for a moment of telling him the truth, that those things are never, ever going to make it to Virginia. But I decide not to. Noah is, among other things, an ex-husband, an opportunist, a havoc wreaker, a double agent, the best lover I've ever had, and I am so ready to be rid of him forever. I decide right that minute that if he heads out to Bali, Wendy Spinnaker can always just wonder what exactly her aunt's wacky career in magic consisted of and why nothing ever turned up in those boxes. She can text him over and over again while he's lying on the beach somewhere, and he can turn over on his towel, adjust his sunglasses, take another sip of his Mai Tai or whatever, and gaze out at the azure sky. But he'll never be able to tell her for sure what happened, because he'll never know. 45. Marnie.
Blix's nefarious magic career is still on my back patio, just so you know.
Shall I put on the tinfoil hat and come down and tackle it?
I believe if you will check your popular cultural references, tinfoil hats only protect you from electromagnetic waves, and therefore cannot have any effect on magic spells.
Oh.
Still, if you have one, bring it. It might look cute.
Should I bring dinner? I bet Roy would like a chicken.
I'm making popovers. I've decided to be the reigning prince of popovers.
A tinfoil crown is definitely in order, then. Oh, we are so clever, aren't we? Tinfoil hats and well-punctuated text messages. That's us. So funny and chaste and clever and innocent. And it is December 2nd, and he is leaving on December 15th, and that will be that. I sit at my table with aluminum foil and a pair of scissors and a cardboard cutout of a crown. What am I doing? Why, making him a crown, of course. To make him smile. To keep up the joke. To make one of our last evenings together fun and companionable. So he'll think, as he's driving cross-country, yes, we had such fun, she and I. Fun, fun, fun. I slam the scissors down on the table and stand up. Oh, my God, I want him. I want to unwrap him, press my head against his chest. I want his mouth grazing my nipple. I want to be in his bed with him again, but I want to be on top of him. I want him to kiss me and not look at me like I'm some kind of monster that he can't give in to. I want Patrick. I want him, I want him, I want him, I want him. I look around the kitchen. The sky is darkening outside already, the lights of the skyline shining against the thick gray clouds of night. I walk around the room, my arms folded tight across my chest, my heart beating so fast. I want him. When I squint, I see them. The sparkles. Oh, my goodness, I see the sparkles again. They're back. If I had the spellbook from his patio, maybe I could figure out if there's a little bit of magic that might work on him, on us, before the time runs out. Then I remember something. The first night I met her, she gave me a scarf when I was leaving, and it's hanging in the closet. I saw it the other day when I was looking at everything. Somehow it always seemed too fancy for me. Like it would have been cheating to wear Blix's essence around my neck that way. But now, tonight, we need the big guns. It all goes wrong from the moment I get there. I'm too shy or too forward or too tense. I forget to bring the chicken, and when I offer to go get one at Paco's, Patrick says not to bother. And I'm wearing a dress, which I see is ridiculous because you can't unpack boxes in a dress.
You can't search through magical artifacts when you're dressed like you wanted to be out at dinner or at a movie instead. And why did you do it? Because you wanted to look beautiful. I'm wearing the best thing in my closet, the black striped dress with the leggings, the dress that shows a little bit of cleavage. Patrick might appreciate the cleavage, and he could peel off the leggings. That's what I was thinking. Your Honor, I plead guilty to lustful thoughts while getting dressed. But now I am here, and there is no chicken, and the popovers are just popovers, flour and milk and eggs and air, and he is in a mood. Too jokey, too something. Brittle, somehow. Guarded. I tell him about Noah and the story of Blix being in line to inherit the family mansion, but then having it stolen from her, and I make it all dramatic, too dramatic, and he asks questions I can't answer, and I'm acting all flustered, and he looks at me funny, and it's probably written all over my face. Dude, I want you. But we can't. He won't. We sit on the floor and go through the boxes, and there's really nothing to it. The book of spells is at the bottom of a box that contains Blix's muumuus and caftans, the dress she wore to my wedding, some fabulous scarves and coats. I take out the book and open it, and I say, "Look at all this magic! It makes me feel like she's right here when I see it." He suddenly gets up and goes over to the sink and starts washing dishes. "What's wrong?" I say.
"Nothing."
"Is it the Blix stuff?" He hesitates, bites his lip, puts a cup in the dish drainer.
"It's the anniversary of the fire."
"Oh. Oh, I'm so sorry."
"Yeah, I'm not fit for company. I'm sorry. I should be by myself."
I go over to the sink and I reach over and touch him. And to my surprise, he doesn't pull away. I touch his arm, and then his hand, where the scars are. I take his hand out of the soapy water. Slowly, I run my finger along a ridge of scar tissue. He lets me. "It wasn't your fault, you know," I say. "You couldn't have changed it." When he speaks, his voice is ragged, and he pulls his arm away from me.
"Yeah, well, if it hadn't been for those 10 seconds... Do you see that if somehow those 10 seconds didn't happen, everything would have been different? 10 seconds, and the world doesn't have any oxygen left for me. It's like the color blue is missing or something. Everything good drained away. I can't. I don't feel anything."
"Oh, Patrick.
My life. You really don't know me. You don't see that my life is a before and after, and that I have to live in the shadows."
"Wait a minute," I say. "I know what's going on here."
"And what is that?"
He closes his eyes.
"Not enough magic?"
"No. You are feeling again. You're seeing there's a bridge to healing, and you're not sure you want to cross it. You might get hurt again. You can stay on the planet of my lover died in the fire as long as you want, but eventually I think you're going to want some company there. Because you survived the fire, and you can heal from this. I think, and I could be wrong about this, so don't get mad, but I think you really can do art again." He's staring at me.
"Now I've done it. I've gone too far." "Did you really say that? That I'm on the planet of my lover died in the fire?"
"I believe I did."
"Well, thank you very much for that image, but I'm not going to do art again. I'm going to planet Leave Me the Fuck Alone, Wyoming, and I'm going to walk along the plains by myself and watch television with my sister."
Giving up.
"Call it whatever you like."
"I do call it giving up. Because, Patrick, I have this unshakable idea about you, which is based on knowing that when the worst thing that ever happened to you happened, you didn't run away from it. You ran toward that fire. And that man isn't going to get away with walking alone on the plains and watching television with his sister. You're healing right now. Don't you see that? This is probably like when those horrible burn wounds were healing and they hurt like hell. This is what your spirit is doing right now, too. But then, maybe things will get better, one angstrom unit at a time. You can get your life back. He turns off the water.
Shut the fuck up,
he says. But he is smiling in a weird way. I honestly think you do not want to give up. He closes his eyes then, like everything just hurts too much. I go over and take Blix's journal and books and my letter out of the boxes, and then I seal them back up with the packing tape. And then I do the bravest, stupidest thing I've ever done, which is tell Patrick that I love him, and that no matter what he thinks, it's not pity, and it's not any of those other lesser values. It's love, love, love. I even say it loudly. Love, love, love. And he does not respond, because he is lost beyond my reach. He has traveled as far as he can go, and he didn't get to where I'm standing. I've watched enough dramatic movies to know that there's nothing to be done. Taking off my clothes wouldn't help. Begging won't help. Even throwing plates or singing or starting to make out with him. Nothing I can think of will help. Not magic. Not making him laugh, not feeding him a popover, one morsel at a time. So, while I still have one shred of pride left, I go home. Because the wisdom that William Sullivan doesn't know is the thing I remember best. When all is lost, the law of giving up will save you every time. But it only works if you're really, really giving up. And I am. Aunt Irene calls me later that night and says she has somebody who wants to come look at the building tomorrow, and I say, bring it on. I have officially given up, and now Blix's place will sell, and I will leave. 46. Marnie. Brooklyn, in a show-offy mood, has its first snowfall on the 15th. It starts snowing before the sun comes up, and by the time I get up, the world has turned white outside. 5 inches have already fallen, and the schools are closed, much to Sammy's delight. The mayor thinks that people should stay home if they possibly can, because this isn't going to stop anytime soon.
The mayor never says that,
Sammy tells me.
Well, maybe 2 times in my lifetime is all,
or 3 times.
Maybe 5 or 1, but it is a big deal. Trust me on that.
He is following me around the kitchen while his parents sleep.
I mean, we have snow days. Sometimes. Not often, but we have them. But a snow day when my mom and dad don't have to work? That never happens. Hardly ever.
Sammy, do you think you'd like some oatmeal, or would you like pancakes?
Oh, pancakes. He says, can we really have pancakes? I never get pancakes on a weekday. That's because there's never enough time. I should call my mom to come over. She loves pancakes. I wonder why my parents are sleeping so late.
It's not late. It's only 8 o'clock, I say.
Maybe I'll go tell them we're having a great breakfast over here.
No, let's let them sleep, I say.
But why are they so tired?
I don't know, but I have a firm belief in letting tired parents sleep. My own parents used to take naps sometimes, in the middle of the day. My sister and I had to leave them alone.
Well, you know what that probably was, don't you?
He says. Do you like butter and syrup or butter and powdered sugar? I say.
They were doing their taxes, I bet, he says. My parents told me that they need a lot of peace and quiet to do their taxes. So when they would take naps in the middle of the day, that's what they were doing.
Then his face breaks out in a big grin. Can I tell you something? Promise you won't tell anybody?
Okay,
I say. Two things, really. The first is that I know about sex, he whispers. My mom told me all about it.
Oh, I say. I love Sammy's non sequiturs, and I have decided to assume that this is simply one of those.
Well, then, what's the second thing?
I heard my mom ask my dad if they should have a whole wedding when they get back together officially, or just go down to the courthouse and sign the papers.
Really? And what did he say?
He said he wants a wedding, and he wants me to walk them down the aisle and have everybody there cheering for all of us. He wants me to hold both their hands.
That's so nice, I say. Are you up for that?
I bet you are.
I'm up for it, he says.
I don't tell him the secret that I know, that Jessica is already pregnant. There's a baby coming in about 8.5 months.
Yeah, she knew early. She's one of those women who knows she's conceived the moment she gets up from the bed, she told me.
She's keeping it from Sammy, she says, until she's absolutely sure everything's okay.
And I have another secret, too.
Andrew's already gone out and bought her a new ring. He says the old wedding ring might have to be put down, like a sick animal. It didn't do its job so great. The new ring is going to be one you can count on for life.
Will that work?
What do I know? All I know is that sometimes miracles simply show up, and you have to take them at face value. What really happened is probably something that Jessica can't put into words. She just made up her mind to love him again.
Maybe it was timing, or, in some weird way, it could have even been the waitress showing up at Thanksgiving. But I can't rule out that it was the spell I did.
I wonder if Blix had these doubts, or if she just cast the spells and asked for the miracles, and then sat back and welcomed anything that came. Maybe this is how the whole system works. You put the wish out there, and then it takes the entire universe operating on your behalf to get it to come true.
If Blix's idea was to put Patrick and me together, though, she's not done so well. I'm awaiting an offer on the house, and right now there's a U-Haul truck parked out in front of the building that's saying that sometimes things simply don't work out.
Patrick is getting ready to leave.
Around 1 o'clock, Sammy and I are bored with playing checkers, doing puzzles, and baking cookies, and I can no longer stand to see that truck sitting there, so we take Bedford out to the park. It's still snowing, but we bundle up. Jessica lends me her snow pants and a parka and a scarf. She's decided she'll stay home and do the lie about the house, napping, and gestating routine. Sammy gets his gear all together, his snow saucer and his mittens and hat and scarf.
Winter requires so much stuff. I don't know how these northerners keep track of it all.
We walk over to Prospect Park with Bedford on his leash. He's fascinated by snow. He wants to run around in circles and bark at the snowflakes. He's really lost his little doggy mind, such as it is, and he's dragging me along, trying to make me go into the street so he can chase more flakes. As for me, I may be just as bad. I can't get over the way the snow feels landing on my nose and face. These are big, fat flakes drifting down to earth looking like jagged pieces of lace all clumped together, soft and delicate. Melting on impact.
The world looks so different, I keep exclaiming. It's like it got all cleaned up.
Sammy shows me where the best sledding hill is, and we take turns, one of us holding the leash while the other rides the saucer down the slope. Every time I get myself on the saucer, tucking in my legs and arms and holding on for dear life, the pan spins me around, and I always seem to go down the hill backward, screaming and laughing and closing my eyes.
If you lean the other way, you won't go backward,
Sammy calls.
Here, lean.
I don't know what you mean, I scream because I've hit an icy patch and I'm careening across the whole length of the park.
Help!
He comes running alongside me, laughing, and saying,
lean left, Marnie! Lean to the left! I mean the other left! Lean to the other left!
I wipe out on the path, and I'm lying there, glad to finally be at a stop, sprawled out on my back, staring up at the sky, feeling the snow coming down right on my face, landing on my mouth and nose and eyes. I can't stop laughing.
Get out of the way! Marnie! Here comes somebody!
Sammy is yelling, and I jump up just in time to avoid being hit by a demon in a red snowsuit, screeching as she barely misses me, going hundreds of miles per hour. The wind whistles past me as she breaks the sound barrier. Oh my God! How am I ever going to not want to do this every day? This is what winter is about? Why didn't anybody ever tell me the good parts? I ask him. We link arms and go trudging up the hill, back to the line again. We're standing in line, on line, and suddenly I look around.
Wait, where's Bedford? Oh no, says Sammy. Where did he go? I went to help you and
It's okay, I say. I'll go find him. You stay on the snow pan.
No, I'm coming with you,
he says. His face has gone pale. We thread our way through the crowds of people all coming to sled and play, calling his name. There's a German shepherd roaming free and a golden retriever who's walking along between some twins like he's their supervisor. No Bedford. A poodle comes by in a fussy sweater and two dachshunds in down jackets.
Bedford! Bedford! Here, boy!
I call. It's snowing harder now, and I can't see quite as far as I want to. Sammy looks like he's about to cry.
This is my fault. I lost him. I lost your dog.
It's fine. We'll find him. Let's go down this other street. Maybe he left the park and started for home.
Yeah, dogs always know the way home, he says. I heard that somewhere.
I don't want to say that I'm not so sure that's true of Bedford. He's been a freelance dog since long before he belonged to me. He may not really know for sure where his home is, or even that he belongs with me. Maybe he met some nice people at the park and trotted off with them because they had fried chicken or something. I may never see him again, and I won't know if he left me for a ham sandwich or if he got taken to the pound. I get out my cell phone and call Jessica.
Are you feeling okay?
I ask when she answers.
I'm now lying about being lazy, she says. What are you doing?
Well, we're having a fine old time, but Bedford seems to have gone missing. Would you mind looking outside and seeing if you can spot his lovely countenance? Sammy has a theory that dogs know to go home when they're lost. After a while, she comes back to the phone.
No sign of him. I'll ask Patrick if he's seen him, and I'll call you back.
Oh, don't bother Patrick. He doesn't even like Bedford. I'm sure he hasn't seen him.
Well, she says. Okay.
I'll keep looking around here for a while, and then Sammy and I will come back. The wind's coming up, and it's getting kind of cold.
I can barely hear you. There's so much noise from the wind, she says.
I know, but listen, my battery is about to die, so we're going to keep searching, and then we'll come back.
Shall I send Andrew? Are you near the pond?
Maybe? I'm not sure exactly, but give me a little while to look before you send him. The phone goes dead.
She hasn't seen him?
Asks Sammy. His shoulders slump, but then he gathers himself up and starts calling again.
Bedford! Bedford!
We walk along. My hands and ears are freezing, and even though the snow has stopped falling, it's even harder to see. By the time it's 4:30, we've walked blocks and blocks, and there's the feeling of twilight. People packing up to go. I think I have possibly lost a couple of toes by now.
I think we have to give up, Sammy boy,
I say. I'm sure he'll show up at home.
But what if he doesn't?
He will. Dogs are smart creatures.
But what if a car hit him or something? What if somebody took him and stole him?
Shh. Let's think positive. He's probably just fine somewhere. Probably he's gone to a bodega and is enjoying a meatball sub in the back. Let's go home and warm up. Get some hot chocolate.
Maybe we'll go out later and look again with your dad. We walk along the sidewalk. I keep peering down the street, trying to see. And then I see two men coming toward us, and one of them is Andrew, and the other one is Patrick. And my stomach feels like it slides down to my toes. Patrick, outside in a flimsy parka and sweatpants, running toward me. He's outside, and he's running to me. And I put my hand over my mouth because this is clearly not good. I freeze in position, but Sammy says, "Dad!" and starts galloping to Andrew's side, blubbering now, talking about the dog and how he's sorry. Andrew leans down and scoops him into a hug, but Patrick keeps coming toward me.
"Bedford,"
he says, and I start to cry. "Oh my God, is he dead?"
"No, but a car hit him, in front of our house. I've been trying to call you."
He stops talking, panting so hard he can't make words right.
"Oh no, where is he? Oh my God, is he going to be okay?"
He bends down, puts his hands on his knees, tries to catch his breath.
"No, it's okay. Going to be okay. I took him to the vet."
"The vet?
You took him..."
"Wait, Patrick, take a deep breath. Breathe." I put my hand on his arm. "Just nod. You saved him, didn't you?" He takes a deep, deep breath and another, and then nods.
"He's going to be okay. A broken leg, they said. They fixed it up. I've been looking for you. Jessica said you and Sammy were sledding..."
"Where is he?"
"The animal hospital, 4 blocks from here. They're setting it now."
Another deep breath.
"So he'll stay there tonight. Make sure there are no further complications."
"You saw it happen? Was it awful?" He straightens up and looks at me.
"I saw it right afterward. He was in the street, and he was lying down crying. And I picked him up and moved him. I probably shouldn't have moved him, but I needed to get him out of the road."
"You picked him up?"
"I did. Well, I had to. He's your dog."
"Oh, Patrick, thank you so much. I'm so glad you did. Oh, my God. I get a dog, and already I've wrecked him." I can't help it. I grab him in a hug, and he lets me. He even puts his arm around me. "How did you know it had happened?"
"I heard it happen. Heard him yelp. So I went out, and the driver of the car was there. He'd pulled over, and he came and talked to me. He said he never even saw him dart out."
"No, he chases snowflakes and loses his mind. Do you think, I mean, can I see him? Ah, oh, that poor dumb mutt."
"Yes, we can see him. They do magical things with dog legs these days, I've heard."
Andrew and Sammy are coming toward us now, and Sammy is holding back tears. Andrew has his arm around his son's shoulders. I've never noticed how alike the two of them look.
"It's my fault, Marnie,"
Sammy says. "No, it isn't. Not at all. Bedford is his own free dog, and he should have followed you. He just got distracted in that doggy way. And you were right. He went home. He probably was chasing some snowflakes and went out into the road because, well, I hate to say it, but he's kind of an idiot dog, you know? He doesn't know much about sidewalks and cars." I hug him, too.
"I'm sorry."
"It's okay, sport,"
says Patrick.
"They're fixing him up."
He looks at me.
"Shall we go over to the animal hospital and see how they're doing with him?"
"Yes, I'd like that," I say. "Wait, you'll really come with me?" He closes his eyes for a moment.
"Yes, of course I'm coming."
Andrew says he and Sammy are going to head home, if that's okay.
"I've got to get this guy into some dry clothes."
I kiss and hug them both goodbye, and then I turn back to Patrick. "Why are you doing this? What in the name of God happened to you since I last talked to you?"
"Do you want to walk or take my truck?"
"Wait, you have a truck?"
"I have the U-Haul. That's how I got the dog to the vet.
You're so full of surprises.
I thought we had a moratorium on the word surprise.
Sometimes it's a good word. We walk for a long time in silence. I keep stealing little looks at him. You don't even really like him. You said you don't have any time for dogs.
Yeah, well, he licked my hand. So that may mean we're bonded for life now.
Patrick.
Yes.
This means more than I can say. Really.
I know.
This is like the most amazing thing anyone's ever done for me.
Listen, I'm not prepared to make a big speech or anything,
he says.
I'm still a wreck. Still me. But I thought about what you said.
Oh my God, Patrick, you're outside. For me.
Yeah, well, I want to go see how this dog of yours is doing. And I want... Well, then I want to start the process where Roy and Bedford get to be friends.
You do? Aren't you moving, like, in 20 minutes? Going to Wyoming?
And then, maybe if you want, we could have an exploratory preliminary talk about how ridiculous it would be if one of us is walking on the plains of Wyoming alone, while the other one is in Florida. Florida, as you say it. You know, as a long-term plan.
He stops walking and faces me and takes both of my hands in his leathery, stitched-together, wonderful hands. The medical miracle hands. His eyes are luminous in the half-darkness.
I probably can't be fixed all the way. You know, there's always going to be some pain. And maybe some visits to that planet. The My Lover Died planet. I may have a permanent parking space there for my spaceship. But I need you. I don't want to live without you.
Patrick!
Please, you don't have to do this. You're going to have to think very hard about what you want. I'm no bargain, believe me. Just tell me this. Could this ever be something you even want?
I close my eyes. So much. He pulls me to him and kisses me so softly.
Is that really true?
He whispers.
You want this?
I nod. I'm about to burst into tears, so I can't trust myself to speak.
Okay,
he says.
So we'll go visit Bedford. Then we have to go home and tell Roy the news. That he's now a dog owner. He's not going to be happy. Believe me.
We start walking again, and the sky gets dark. And yes, there may be sparkles everywhere I look, or maybe it's just the streetlights coming on and shining on the snow. We can't stop smiling. Smiling and walking and holding hands.
You do know there are going to be piles of problems, right?
He says, about half a block later.
This isn't going to be like,
Patrick. I say.
What?
I may need you to be quiet just now so I can love on you better. I'm thinking how it's going to be so amazing unwrapping you.
Unwrapping me? Did you say? You are?
Yes, I say. Yes, yes, yes. I've been thinking of nothing else.
If you'd been texting that, would there have been periods or commas between all those yeses?
I stop walking then and put my arms around him, and he kisses me again and again. And it's the best, really. Kisses that have exclamation points between them. Like all the yeses from now on. 47. Marnie. On the day that the 3 months are up, Charles Sanford gives me the papers to sign, now fully accepting the terms of the will, and then he hands me the last letter from Blix, the letter he'd explained would be mine once I'd fulfilled the terms of the will.
Just out of curiosity, I ask him, did she really write me two letters? One if I was staying and one if I was going? He laughs a little bit.
Well, no, not really.
Oh, because she would have been too disappointed in me if I'd gone back to my regular life, I say.
That's one way to look at it. But probably it was more that she was always sure you wouldn't.
But I almost did, I say. I even had a real estate agent showing the house. I had a plane ticket home.
And he smiles. Yes, but no offers ever materialized, did they? And you decided to stay. You see, Blix didn't deal in almosts. She knew what she was doing.
I go to the Starbucks where I had read her first letter 3 months ago, and then I open up this letter, my heart beating fast.
Marnie, my love, welcome to your big, big life. Sweetheart, it worked out just as I knew it would, for the good of all. As you look around you, I know you're seeing all the non-stop, everyday, and everywhere miracles. They are everywhere. And, sweetheart, keep loving him. He's a good man, damaged and broken. But as someone wiser than me said, it's in the broken places where the light gets in. And as you and I both know, he is luminous, filled with trapped light. It beams out of his eyes, doesn't it, darling? I also want you to know that he has a Hawaiian shirt, and he has straw hats, and when he puts those on and dances, you are not going to believe the transformation that takes place. I am there with you, loving every minute. So live your little hearts out. Love is everything there is. Never forget who you are. Love. Blix.
I put down the letter and smile off into the distance. So she did know. She fixed it so it would happen just this way. I feel like if I turned around fast enough, if the principles of time and space could somehow allow it, I'd see her there, dancing in the street, twirling with her hands in the air, just the way she danced at my wedding. And I wonder if she knew even way back then that I was meant for Patrick. Someday, I hope I can ask her. Oh, yeah, it's now a year later, and here are some other things that have happened. My parents were upset at first about me staying in Brooklyn and could barely stand that I broke Jeremy's heart 2 times, but they came around. Parents always do when they see you are truly happy. My mother said she just knew, with a mother's intuition, that when I went to Brooklyn, my whole life was going to change. And she's resigned to the fact that I'll turn into a northerner and that my children, when Patrick and I get around to having them, will speak northern instead of southern. Natalie has visited me and met Patrick. She said she needed to see my life here, to figure out what in the world Brooklyn offered. She left still perplexed, I'm afraid. She'll always prefer big green lawns, swimming pools, and the quiet certainty of a suburban boulevard at midday. Me? I love how the city wakes up merely 2 hours after it went to sleep, and the way the 643 bus roars around the corner and hits the pothole, the same pothole, every single morning. And how the dance of the city means you never know who's going to show up next on your street, in your life. Jeremy. Well, now Jeremy is really the casualty of the whole situation. No getting around that. What can I say? Such a nice guy. And I know he's telling himself the story of how nice guys always finish last, never get the girl. He joked that maybe he and I will try again when I'm between husbands number 2 and 3. I told him that wasn't funny at all, but actually I was happy to hear him say that. Maybe it means that his snarkiness is coming back. William Sullivan is on number 92 of a year of 100 dates with Lola. He says he has the patience of a mule, and I happen to know that she's been to the drugstore for products that make things easier, you know? On their 100th date, he tells me, not only is he going to propose, but they're going to figure out whether to move to New Jersey or stay in Brooklyn. Lola told me they're staying, and she thinks Walter will be fine with that. Andrew and Jessica, now members of a family of four, bought a house in Ditmas Park, a much more residential section of Brooklyn. They're planning a spring wedding. Best man? Sammy. The maid of honor will only be 9 months old, so her mother plans to carry her up the aisle. Sammy's school bus brings him to me after school twice a week, and we sit in the kitchen while he works on the poem he's going to read for the wedding toast. It's a pretty good bet we'll be hearing about the further adventures of the egg and the toast. And some new tenants moved into Jessica's apartment. Layla and Amanda, who will forever after be known as the lesbian moms, a title they love, by the way. Their baby is adorable. And their sperm donor, the one they were writing the note to when I first met them at Best Buds, well, I have to say he's around a fair amount too. I've been asked if I can think of a spell that might bring him his own woman and baby. Oh, and then there's Patrick. And, well, Patrick is still Patrick. Wonderful and generous, startled by life and all it can hold. I talked him into quitting his depressing job when he moved in with me upstairs. Now at night, I'll see a wistful look come to his face, and he'll get his watercolors out and take my hand, and we go up on the roof, where he paints the Brooklyn sunsets and the skyline, while Bedford and Roy and I keep him company. He's taking photographs, too, going outside and taking pictures of everything that Brooklyn holds for both of us. Here's something. The other day, we were in a store buying art supplies, and there was a little girl, about 4 years old, who was staring at him curiously. Normally, Patrick would have tightened up, scowling and turning away. But this time, I watched as he bent down there to her level, and then she reached her little hands up and lightly touched his skin, ran her fingers slowly along the scars and the places where the skin is pulled tight. I could hardly breathe. I saw them look into each other's eyes, and then she said, in barely a whisper, "Does it hurt?" And he smiled at her, closed his eyes for just a moment, and then he said, "No, no more hurt. Not anymore." You don't know, until there's a moment like that, how much more space there can be in your heart, how much breathing room there is out in the world just for you. That's when you learn for sure that love will win in the end. It just will. As for me, I'm still working at Best Buds, and I keep the Book of Spells right there with me, with all its vines and flowers on the cover, because sometimes I add in one of Blix's little blessings when a customer needs some magic along with their bouquet. Oh, and Patrick and I are working together on baking cupcakes with the little messages in them. We figured it out, I think. Just last night, I told him that all the messages should say the same thing. Whatever happens, love that. Because, as Blix told me at the wedding, if you need a mantra, that's one of the best. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Matchmaking for Beginners by Maddie Dawson, performed by Amy McFadden and Joyce Bean, engineered by Matt Churchill and Laura Stahl. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.